This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of The Sounding of the Whale, a talk and book launch with historian of science and Cabinet editor D. Graham Burnett, held in celebration of the publication of his book of the same title. The event took place on January 28th, 2012.
All right, good evening, everyone. My name is Jeff Dolvin, and it is a great pleasure to introduce my colleague and my great friend, Graham Burnett, familiar to many of you, but he's a professor of history and history of science at Princeton, and he's a true polymath. His first book, Masters of All They Surveyed, it's a study of survey and empire in British Guiana, published in 2000. There's also a book about optics, Descartes, and the hyperbolic quest. There's a report from the jury room of a murder trial called A Trial by Jury. Most recently, there's a positively bantamweight whale book at only 304 pages about whale science at the beginning of the 19th century, which is called Trying Leviathan. And on top of that, he is an editor and a frequent contributor here at Cabinet Magazine, among other enterprises. But grateful as we are for these various gifts, we're here to celebrate something new, and that is his magnum opus, The Sounding of the Whale, Science and Cetaceans in the 20th Century. And in one way or another, Graham has been working on this book all the time that I've known him, which is now 11 years, in archives around the world and around the country, and at his desk. Many times I've dropped in to find him at that desk with piles of cetaceana banked around him, reading, writing, listening on the stereo to whale songs. Sometimes I feel like I've caught him singing along with those songs. And now the book is with us, and I think I could do worse in summarizing its terrestrial importance than to quote from a handful of the recent reviews. A sweeping, important study of cetacean science and policy, says the New York Times. By questioning the very nature of our scientific interest in the whale, Burnett has set the tone for a new century of discovery, and one hopes recovery, says Nature. Burnett's brilliant and often wryly humorous study stands as a testament to the uneasy role of science in the standoff between human history and natural history, says the Telegraph. One especially acute review referencing the great predecessor monument of whale writing. As in Melville's Moby Dick, the scale of the issues that surround the whale seem to stretch the very bounds of human knowledge, from the Financial Times. And I think you'll agree that these are testaments to an important event, responses that are enlightened by this book, informed by this book, I think moved by this book, but in some respects, I think predictable. And I really mean that only from a species perspective. That is, these are the sorts of things that we say when a great book makes land with us. But I did find myself curious about its wider reception. And so I spent a lot of time this last week on the Staten Island Ferry, kind of going back and forth. And I took along my iPhone, which I wrapped in a plastic bag like this and had on a long string. And I would surreptitiously walk to the rail, and you know, these omnicompetent devices, they play music for you, they also listen, they record things. And so I dipped it down into the water, and then when I got home, I'd pull it back up, and I'd listen to what I found. And it turns out that there is just as much conversation underwater about this book as there is up here. And I thought is there a plug I could use? Could I plug this thing in, Sina?
It's on the
here. Oh, okay, great. So I can't claim to be fluent in whale song, but being around Graham, I've picked up a little bit. And so I'm going to play you a little bit of what I recorded, and I'll try to translate as I go, let you know what they're saying down there. So the mournfulness is immediate, palpable, I think something of a refrain. Read this book as a whale. It's a hard 100 years, they say. A hard, hard 100 years. And you hear that deep submarine grouse there. It's long, long. The semester, maybe the book. This one, I think, is saying, and maybe in response, like us, he is a believer in total immersion. Total immersion. And here, I think, if I'm right, they're actually quoting from the book, from the very end of the book. And so I'm just going to read Graham's language, because I think that's what we've got. For a number of years, I have read my way through tens of thousands of pages of published and unpublished sources in an effort to make sense of what seemed to me, from the outset, an ambitious but by no means overwhelming subject. And you can imagine the kind of anthropological boggle of these animals trying to make sense of this scholarly enterprise that Graham has undertaken and achieved. And here, the fundamental lesson I have taken from the research and writing of this book amounts to nothing less than a kind of sweeping epistemological humiliation. And then I think one of them says, maybe reflecting on that humiliation, I'm talking about us, well, they may save themselves yet. Amen. So this is a book. This is a book to make us uneasy about having hands, but I can think of no better use for them right now than to join me in welcoming Graham Burnett to tell us more about the sound of the world.
Okay, thank you. Difficult to resist a little Malviliana. At the beginning of chapter 104 of Moby Dick, in a chapter called The Fossil Whale, Melville Ishmael writes, "How then with me writing of this Leviathan? Unconsciously, my chirography expands into placard capitals. Give me a Condor's quill, give me Vesuvius's crater for an inkstand, and then the key line, friends, hold my arms." And so I'd just like to begin in a testimony to some friends who really kind of made this project, this book, possible. Jeff, in a very particular way, who's been with me and by me through this whole thing. Just give me this. And then I'll come to these creatures in just a minute. Yeah, she says that's the front of the book. And she's Consuelo is very invested in this book because this book is her. So she understands this, not entirely wrongly, for celebration. So that's why you see this level of investment. And the slightly slimmer whale book adverted to previously, Trying Leviathan, is in fact dedicated to Francesca. So we'll spend a moment on that before we're done. But back to friends. Also, cabinet friends. Cabinet over the last kind of 4 or 5 years came to feel really like a second home. Jeff Kastner, Sina Najafi in a particular way. For a period of time this summer, it was actually my home, which was kind of a surprise. We can talk about that later if you want. Suffice it to say that in many ways they brought a kind of grace to the end game of this project I wouldn't have believed possible. And then there are a bunch of people who actually kind of helped me do the book. Friends hold my arms in that literal way. Allusion, of course, to Exodus 17, Moses in the battle with the Amaleks. He needs people to hold his arms up to keep the battle going. And some of the research assistants who kind of helped me pull this thing together are here. I see Henry Coles, who gave the text a very substantial reading in the endgame and improved it in important ways. Janani Srinivasan, who actually I found laughing hysterically to herself in a solitary office. She completed work on the bibliography, and I was concerned we might lose. There were a few research assistants who fell by the wayside, tragically. Robert Bruzewitz, who was sufficiently alienated by the whole experience of working this deeply on any research project that he joined the security establishment and can't be here today because he told me he was flying out of Dulles to an undescribed location where he was doing work for the Pentagon. But Brusewitz, who was a football player, was 6'5" and an offensive lineman. And the greatest advantage of having him as a research assistant was that he could, in really only 3 trips, renew all of my library books, which at that point there was about 1,200 library books that I had out from Firestone, and Brusewitz could essentially shoulder the whole mass of stuff and take it over there in just a couple of trips. Wonderful. Joe Nardello, who was one of the launch people on the project. Christine Kim, who fled to Berlin and began working on semiotics after spending some time with Whale Song, people who helped make the project happen. So my thanks to them. What I'd like to do with the time we have is really talk a little bit about the book, just quickly. But I'm not going to do too much talking about the book. And I'm not going to do that because as I thought about how it would be fun for us to spend, you know, 20 minutes or so together before turning to the mock whale appetizers and popping a little Prosecco, so I'll turn you over to the bar and to Kyle Borman, who's worked. You may still smell a little richness in the air. That's the seared pork belly that will be served with a jellied crustacean broth. So you'll get to hear about that in about a half an hour. But I thought it would be fun for us to actually look at a text together. So I'm going to play a short film, a crazy film, a Disney film from 1946 called Willie the Operatic Whale, which some of you will know, but perhaps not all of you. And if you do know it, you'll know it again after we read it in context, if you like it. We see it in context, thinking cetologically. But let me do just a minute or two on the book itself. So, right, Drawing Leviathan. That's this one. That's this one. This one. That's this one. I actually have an awesome little video where they compare them, and Francesca complains, in fact. It's fair to say this, right? You complain that yours is so thin in comparison to Francesca, to Consuelo's. Okay, so what does the book do? I mean, the book is interested in, it sort of takes off from scenes like this. That's an inflatable whale. 1972, the Stockholm UN conference on the environment. And as some of you will know, that conference, a major moment in the history of environmentalism globally. And that conference was substantially hijacked by the Save the Whale movement, which was emergent at that moment. And this inflatable whale was part of that hijacking, marched through the streets of Stockholm. The UN ends up voting a proposal for a global moratorium on whale hunting. By 1976, a kind of mainstream figure like Gilbert Grosvenor, president of the National Geographic Society, could say something like, the whale has become a way of thinking about our planet and its creatures. And he was saying that just shortly after kind of 45 seconds of Super 8 footage that became generational, I think, namely the image of the young Greenpeace activists putting their Zodiac between one of the Russian whalers on the Mendocino Ridge hunting for sperm whales. This was in late 1975. And actually having the Russians, who were not by this point familiar with this as like regular evening television, now it's like on cable every night, but it was new in 1975. And the Soviet whalers actually fired one of these grenade harpoons right over the heads of the Greenpeace guys in their Zodiac. It's a pretty dramatic bit of footage shown by Walter Cronkite on the evening news, and probably the single kind of galvanic moment for shifting the character of the debate in the period, a David and Goliath type moment. But the point of the book, because I'm a historian, is to reach back and show, you know, it was not ever thus, right? I mean, these extraordinary archival photographs, which came to light in the Natural History Museum in London, depict a factory vessel circa 1926. And I don't know if you can see. Do I have a laser? I do. These, right, are the jawbones of a blue whale. Right, so you see them being stripped of the bits of blubber that are on them, and then also the little short baleen that's characteristic of them. These sort of Stygian images, or this watercolor painted by a biologist, an English biologist, 1925 in South Georgia, a small island ridge on the Antarctic convergence, basically, a little bigger than Long Island, which became the locus of the hunt in the 20s when the Southern Ocean was opened to whaling in a serious way. Quickly, modern whaling, nothing to do with 19th century whaling, right? 19th century whaling, guys with like cold harpoons rowing after whales. 20th century whaling, explosive ordnance, military technology, both cannon fired like a howitzer, but then explosive grenade, and the technology involved developing a grenade harpoon that could explode into the animal, leave the line tethered in the animal so that the explosion wouldn't sever the line, because that's no good, and then if not kill the animal immediately, kill it pretty quickly with blood loss. Also the development of compressed air technologies that permitted you then to pump the carcass of the whale full of air so that it would float, because blue and fin whales, the quarry of the 20th century industry, sink almost immediately because they are so muscle dense and they have relatively thin blubber by comparison to the right whales or sperm whales that were primarily hunted in the 19th century. So very different 20th century industry. So you can see these are actually the elevators that were used for bringing the chunks of blubber and meat up into the boiler houses. And these, of course, bloated whales, autolysis, internal corruption generates gases that cause the animals to float up very high eventually. And you can see these ant-like figures working on the whales below. Another amazing image of from about 1924 of one of the very earliest factory processing vessels. This is a blue whale being drawn up the slipway of the stern. This is, again, an archival photograph from the Natural History Museum. And to shift into the kind of better killing through chemistry phase of all of this in the 50s, and to specify the time frame where we really have some explaining to do, check this out. I have a friend, a chemical engineer of considerable prominence, this is from 1956, who's always been fascinated by sausage machines. And his idea is to haul the whale up into a structure with a huge, like a huge coffin, and then either cut it up with a power-driven super meat slicer, all the blades going simultaneously straight through the whale, after which the bottom of the box automatically drops all the slices into boilers, or alternatively to seal the coffin and just boil the entire whale under pressure, like a huge pressure cooker. In either case, improved chemical methods would be relied upon to separate whatever grades of whatever kinds of oil are needed from the resultant animal crude oil. So this is a kind of floating cracking plant. You guys are aware that the 20th century, do you know what was all the whale oil used for in the 20th century?
Cosmetics.
Some cosmetics. I hear lamps, which is someone who's thinking 19th century. So 19th century, the oil is used for illumination. That industry basically brought to a close, probably less through overhunting than through substitution by petroleum products. 20th century industry not used for illumination. That oil is used like 90. One more guess, anyone? It's so gross, it's going to blow your minds. Some machine grease, yeah. Yeah, lubricating machines. So cosmetics and lubricating machine is spermaceti oil, which was used for those purposes. But that was like maybe only 25% of the total 20th century industry, so very small. I know Henry Coles knows, but my research assistants are gracious in remaining quiet. Margarine. Okay? So after 1914 and the development of nickel catalysts for hydrogenation, liquid whale oil can be hydrogenated into a solid butter substitute. And that is what the Germans do first, and then it's done in the UK. Not much of that hydrogenated whale oil comes into the United States, as it happens, because of the power of the dairy lobby here, and also the power of the agricultural lobby, which preferred corn oil for margarine to whale oil, as you can imagine. So, but in Europe, that was the main thing. So you see an arc, right? I mean, there's stuff changes over the 20th century, no question. Heart of this book, how did these creatures go from being understood as monstrous kegs of fat and fertilizer circa 1900 to serving as the totemic megafauna of countercultural protest, environmental activism, and anti-war protest circa 1975? And above all, what role did science and scientists play in the changing conceptions of cetaceans across the 20th century? So this is not like a cultural history, except incidentally or obliquely, if you like. Its central preoccupation is with changing ideas of whale knowledge across the period, and that's what I try to do. So I'll take just a second, Konsu, You are doing such great. Will you do the quiet tap dancing though? The soft? No, the loud? Okay. You don't. One does not mess with Consuelo. So Consuelo, do it as you like. This is a cartoon from 1928 that depicts the first major expedition to go and try to understand whales. It's extremely funny in one sense, because not only does it sort of combine a sort of Galileo-like figure here in the crow's nests as he goes to explore life's problem, the whales of the Southern Ocean, but you see that basic biological knowledge was sufficiently kind of question mark, that you've got the whale exhaling oxygen, which again, think back to AP Bio, you know that makes the whale a plant, right? Which it's not. But anyway, just like, you know, fun with the past. The book is basically grossly, for summary purposes, divided into three sections. The first section deals with the early basic biological work to be done in these animals as people figured out that they were being probably overhunted, but nobody could say for sure because nobody knew enough about their basic biology, where they went, reproductive rates, physiology. So I trace the early kind of what I call hip boot biologists, hip boot whale biologists, who spent, in some cases, half a decade, sometimes more, up to their waists in the viscera of what was genuinely the most horrendous organic holocaust to that point. These were conditions that broke the vast majority of the biologists who went to these regions. They went there to try to study life under conditions of pervasive death and smoking annihilation. Deception Island, which was a small volcanic cove in the Scotia archipelago, and which was used by whalers in this period when they were still just peeling the blubber layer off the animals and letting what was called the scrot go, the actual peeled carcass. They weren't processing that. Deception Island, which had hydrothermal vents so the water didn't get as cold as you might have hoped, by the 1930s, the organic residue on the downwind side of that circular bay was so thick that a human person couldn't walk the beach, because if you walked the beach, you would simply sink down above your like level to breathe in what was a kind of froth of death. I mean, in some places 12 or 13 feet deep that had blown down from 10 years of hunting 45 and 50,000 animals a season. So what it is to study life in this under these conditions is part of what I'm interested in the book. A couple more kind of pictures to give you a sense of what happens to the animals. They were collecting basic biological data. They were trying to understand growth rates. This is such a biologist checking fusion of the epiphyses to try to understand whether the animal was mature. And they marked the animals with darts in order to try to understand their migration patterns. And there is a very funny episode alluded to in the invitation to this event, where in Britain, a group of naturalists get interested in building a huge crossbow because they think that guns will scare the animals, so they want to mark them with crossbow bolts. And they hire the most, the most important early 20th century English physicist, C.B. Boys, and give him essentially an unlimited budget to build a pre-space-aged mega crossbow. And this device is so terrifying that it only gets used a couple of times because the reverb on the springs could basically slice the gunner in half. It had to be mounted on an anti-aircraft gun carriage. The episodes on this basically make, as I say in a footnote, Monty Python read like mere journalism. If you want a bunch of English dons experimenting with a group of medievalists, bow hunters, and physicists with nonstop budget, and they practiced on cows in the forum of the British Museum. So they had these, they printed up invites to come to the cow shooting, and they would herd cows in, shoot them with this incredible thing. So anyway, there's some comic relief. What are these guys trying to generate? They're trying to generate information like this, which combines geographical information about the patterns of movement of the animals with reproductive information about their reproductive physiology, calving, breeding, all that kind of stuff. That's part one, basically, of the book, basic biology across the first, say, third of the 20th century. Populations collapse around the war years, in part because of, well, reduced hunting reduces the catch in this period, but you can see that people get a pretty clear sense that this is unsustainable in the 30s. The population of humpbacks crashes very early, and that gives clear warning of what's going on. Part two of the book looks at science and policy after the founding of the International Whaling Commission in 1946. That was a kind of very hopeful and exciting effort to try to regulate an exploitative industry using science globally. These were resources that were beyond any national jurisdiction. That was unprecedented. If you stop and think about it, there is no fishery off shelf until the 1950s. So whales are really the only kind of globally exploited resource that is totally beyond any national jurisdiction. And it's that that gives rise to the need for a radically new structure for international regulation. I won't bore you with like why that's interesting in the history of environmentalism or science policy, but you can sort of kind of make it up in your head. Upshot is that the IWC is the first organization that actually is founded internationally and that is going to make recommendations to control the hunt based on scientific findings. So they have to have a bunch of scientists around advising them. Who are those scientists and what kind of work do they do? Well, interestingly, they're those guys I was talking about before, these guys, who, as it turns out, most of them spent a decade hanging out with the whalers. Small fact. These guys kind of had come to like pretty much think of themselves as kind of like whalers, if you see what I mean. I mean, they were doing two things, right? Shooting the whales and cutting them up. And what do whalers do? They shoot the whales and they cut them up. So the culture of field work, if you like, had sort of normed these guys to the industry in a way that made it very hard for them then to show up and do a lot of really interesting regulatory work. That's one of the basic things I argue in the book. The guys who show up and do that regulatory work in a serious way are a set of mathematicians and statisticians. There's a long section of the book that deals with that the Times reviewer said was a little tough going, and that's fair enough. It is a little tough going, that section. But then it bounces back in section where we look at the Cold War, and you start talking about dolphins, Cold War, World War II, sonar systems, start hearing this whale song of which Jeff has spoken so eloquently. You also discover that dolphins have incredible capacities for echolocation, which makes them super interesting to the Navy. And this is actually an image from a book in 1963. It's kind of a bionic hypothesis of the melon in the heads of the odontocetes, arguing that they had an acoustic lens system for focusing their sonar blast that was the exact analog of what Lockheed was trying to produce for American sonar systems. So there were major investigations by military contractors to try to understand how the systems work. This is actually one of my favorite weirdnesses to come out of the book. This is how to drive a dead whale. This is a porpoise cadaver, and you've implanted a miniature sound projector, and you've got what is in effect a huge stereotactic frame. And then you and your friends in Point Magoo can use this steering wheel to steer the dead whale underwater and map. This is to map a sonar projection field on the animals and to try to get a sense of whether they have the capacity for directional sonar. Cold War, so here are some of those polar projection coordinates for porpoise cadavers. Just to give you a flavor. So part three, which deals with this Cold War moment, is especially concerned with this guy. I won't talk about him today, although he's the best part of the book. I won't talk about him because I've talked about him before. And John Lilly works on dolphins. Incredible, weird, strange guy. I see Nick Langlitz, who knows a fair bit about Lilly's work with psychopharmaceuticals. He is a kind of leery figure. He's a neurophysiologist working on cortical mapping in the 1950s, gets interested in dolphins because he's tired of working on macaques and tired of smelling monkey shit. And so he decides to work on dolphins. He gets a bunch of money to build a laboratory in the U.S. Virgin Islands, money from NASA, among other people, because he argues that dolphins would make great, are you ready, animal model for interspecies communication. So who visits down here? Carl Sagan, all the SETI guys, because they're trying to figure out if we kind of start picking up signals from little green men, which is a big question in the early 60s, how will we kind of work to get past the species barrier? And so why wouldn't we break through to a species that's here local, super intelligent, Lilly argued, and amenable to the to communicative encounter? This gets a little hairy when Lilly himself, like Leary, tunes in, turns on, drops out, begins using LSD to kind of enhance communicative possibilities with the animals, begins using some of the other elements of the armament of Cold War Manchurian candidate era sciences of mind and behavior, i.e. isolating the dolphins with pretty women in bathing suits to see if he can kind of bring them across using tactics of kind of erotic manipulation. This is arguably successful from Lilly's perspective. Peer review says no. But he does write a bestseller, and that, you know, is its own kind of thing. And in ways that I won't argue now in detail, part of what comes out of that is the extraordinary Payne and McVeigh Songs of the Humpback Whales. Lilly's work on parsing dolphin phonation, where he was looking for speech patterns, ended up being essential to this guy, Scott McVeigh, who worked on these Navy-recorded humpback whale phonations, which had just been treated as noise by the Navy, which was constantly trying to filter out a lot of like underwater sound. He used the same techniques for phonemic parsing that he developed working with Lilly to parse these recordings and discovered repeating elements that he argued were song-like, and the rest is history. That was the soundtrack for the key moment in the 70s where all of this really goes. That's the morning song you're hearing, okay? If it gets louder, we'll talk about that. Okay, so basically, that's where I wanted to kind of end on this side of things. Konsu, you want to come up here with me? Yeah? Sure. Come. Oh, sorry. Did I pull your hair a bit? So what I want to do now is show this this quirky film. What time is it? Just check on time.
Five to six.
Yeah. Let's do that. Let's do that. So let me just switch over. So what you're going to be watching is a film from 1946. It's a Disney film. And I want you to be thinking in terms of bioacoustics, Navy, sonar systems, and also recording technologies. This is pre-stereo. This is pre-overdubbing, really. If there are any like deep experts of sound stuff, you may know there was a little overdubbing work. But this is the story that combines elements of Moby Dick, elements of the Jonah story, elements of that lovely Emily Dickinson poem, Split the Lark, and see what you think. We'll have stuff to talk about, and we'll do a little Q&A one second.
Impresario of the Grand Opera.
raised an eyebrow and tried to figure it out.
This well, she's maybe swallowed a hopper singer. Does it?
This well, she's swallowed a hopper singer. I find the great Signor Donatelli in the fish market. I discovered the great Lily Galley in the honky tonky. Then why not I find the hopper singer in the belly of a whale? Huh? I do it! Oh, get me a great big schooner and get me a good harpooner. Photographers and reporters from all the newspapers. Publicity, publicity, publicity.
Publicity, yes. But to Whitey the Seagull, it was opportunity. The big opportunity for his friend, Willie the Whale. There was no time to lose. He must bring these two together. Well, there was Tetti-Tatti now. And Tetti-Tatti was in for a wonderful surprise. Because Willie hadn't swallowed any opera singer. He could really sing. Listen.
Mammy's little baby loves shortening, shortening. Mammy's little baby loves shortening bread. Mammy's little baby loves shortening, shortening. Mammy's little baby loves shortening bread. Two little children lying in bed. One of them sick and almost dead. Called for the doctor said, feed them children on shortening bread. Mammy's little baby loves shortening, shortening. Mammy's little baby loves shortening bread. Mammy's little baby loves shortening, shortening. Mammy's little baby loves shortening bread.
After all these years of casting his shortening bread upon the waters, now at last success lay just over the waves. Willie, look! That's you, Willie. He's looking for you. It's your big opportunity. Willie's going to be a great star. Our Willie, going to sing grand opera.
Goodbye, my friends. I'm off to be discovered. La 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 la. I'm off to be discovered.
At last, the long years of patient waiting, the endless hours of faithful practice were about to be rewarded. As Willie sped to his audition, he wondered what he should sing for his opening number. What would impress this impresario? How about a bit of Figaro? Yeah, sure. Figaro.
There she's a blows! There she's a blows! Figaro! 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 I'm a piccola, con la bocca per carità, per carità.
Shoot at the well!
Una volta per carri.
Figaro! Figaro! Hey! Figaro!
Son qua, Figaro qua, Figaro là, Figaro qua, Figaro là, Figaro su, Figaro giù, Figaro su, Figaro giù. Forza fortissimo, sono come fomine, sono al ricordo della città, della città, della città, della città, della città. Bravo, Figaro, bravo, bravissimo, bravo, Figaro, bravo, bravissimo, fortunatissimo, fortunatissimo, fortunatissimo.
Hurry up, hurry up! Rescue the hopper singer!
Fortunatissimo, 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 per verità, sono attaccato alla città.
Hadn't heard that. a half of it. They hadn't even heard a third of it. But Willie was no ordinary singing whale. Willie could sing in three separate voices. Tenor, baritone, and bass. Why, Willie was a singing miracle.
Io spera che me la vita tronca per il mio spavento.
Who did that to me, Hoff? This is the mutiny!
Vivo ancora per mio tormento. Dammi il rovina del velo. La cosa vera è bello.
Mamma mia! He's a swallow tua, Hoff, for a sing.
Right there before his very eyes was the biggest discovery in all musical history. Just imagine, a whale singing opera on the very stage of the Met.
Thank you.
Now Willie will never sing at the Met. But don't be too harsh on Tetti Tatti. He just didn't understand. You see, Willie's singing was a miracle. And people aren't used to miracles. And you, faithful little friend, don't be too sad. Because miracles never really die. And somewhere in whatever heaven is reserved for creatures of the deep, Willie is still singing. In 100 voices, each more golden than before. And he'll go on singing, amid the applause and the cheering, forever.
Yeah. It's such a lovely moment there at the end, and such a lovely presentation in general. I can't wait to look at the book. I just wanted to ask maybe if you would reflect on sound from maybe a couple different angles. I mean, there's an extremely long history, of course, you know, of sound. We can't close our ears, and there's the notion of kind of over-sensory overload from the Greeks through polyphony, devotional music in the Western European tradition. As a kind of an access to a particular kind of real, let's say, or moving outside both the bodily experience and oral experience and any kind of other experience, and experiencing nature in the different kinds of levels of reality. And I just, you know, it's just so fascinating that the whale and then this operatic sonic overload are these two points, these two kind of focal points into an experience of nature beyond the self, into this sense of the real. And I just, you know, I love your title. I just maybe would ask you to reflect on why is it sound, and when is it sound that is a way into these kind of extra sensory, extra self experiences? Why go to sound? And then, you know, of course, how does sound bring out this particular problem in your book?
Yeah, so I mean, the answer is that in one way, that movie is a serious problem for the argument of the book. You're hearing it now. It kind of sucks to write an 820-page book and then blow up the argument of the book at the book party. But why not? What's scholarship for, right, if we don't, you know, destroy? One of the core arguments of the book is that it was impossible for people to hear cetacean phonation as song until after Lilly's work. And I argue that he kind of prepared the space of the possible for that kind of hearing. Through his work on cetacean intelligence. And it's a very elaborate argument. What do you do with the fact then that in 1946, when, you know, Lilly is still doing aviation technologies for the Air Force? Yeah, give me 1 second. There is this level of interest. of whales singing. Totally screws up the last 200 pages of the book, okay? Now, that said, since that's a bit of a downer, the question of how Lilly himself thinks about listening and hearing and acoustic technologies and these animals, fascinating. His idea that the animals are morally superior to us has everything to do with the fact that they are transparent to each other because they see with sound. Animals can see through each other. There's no place for them to hide. You know, if they're feeling a little sick or they have gas in their bowels or whatever, that's transparent. And also he ends up arguing that they have a kind of form of collective cognition that's produced through the fact that when they're operating in pods, they all hear everybody else's echolocatory information. And because that information is a spatialized portrayal of their environment, everybody is always experiencing their environment from the perspective of everybody else in the pod simultaneously. So now take two hits from the bong, put on your stereo headphones, and think about how cool that would be, right? Because the stereo is spatializing sound for the first time. You know these animals are literally able to blast broadcast what might well be spatial information, because they interpret spatial information acoustically, and you're really traipsing over into the terrain of sort of psychedelia, right? And it's will come as no surprise to some of you to learn that Lilly was the inventor of the flotation tank, originally as a Cold War mind sciences technology for sensory deprivation, but he sets one up down in the Virgin Islands to like hang in it and think about what it would be like to be a dolphin. And he has his acoustic stereophones in the tank hooked up to the dolphin tank so they can kind of, you know, bond. And that technology kind of begins to cross over the watershed from Cold War technology to countercultural technology, and it does so kind of in Lily's hands, or you know, with Lily in the hot tub. Other? Yeah.
Even the, you know, those swarthy Italian shipmen, I felt as though watching that their color sort of darkened as they got in with his songs. And even as he was becoming more European in his repertoire, they were becoming maybe a little bit more African in their appearance. It's incredibly complicated. So that's the question, in a sense, are whales black?
Right.
And especially going over to the civil rights movement, you're talking about whales in the counterculture. Is that
So, I mean, you could have knocked me. So, right, the question sounds too recherché even to hope to engage, and yet, So, Lilly, in that best-selling whale book, he has a section where he's like, we are going to confront the main problem. He's steeped at this point, of course, in kind of Planet of the Apes type stuff. He says, we're going to confront an amazing problem when people realize that we've broken through to the dolphin and that they are very intelligent. We're going to face a problem very much like the problem we've faced over the last 30 years with the African Negro, where there's going to be a question of enfranchisement and rights. And he plays out the analogy between, yeah, sorry about that. I leaned her against the steam pipe. Oof, sorry, she's sucking it up here. He literally plays out the analogy to the civil rights movement in order to kind of get people thinking about the cetaceans. There's a different tie-in, which is that 1972, that inflatable whale being marched through Stockholm, it's a wonderful moment in the history of the global environmental movement. It's a very awkward moment in the history of actually kind of giving a shit about human welfare in one sense, because there's pretty good evidence that that whole shtick was semi-plotted. I don't want to overstate here, but the US loved the idea of the UN conference on the human environment being shanghaied by the whale, because Eastern Bloc countries had embarked on a plan to make it about exploitative capitalism and its destruction of ecosystems and the way in which people in the global south were having their lives destroyed with their natures. And the US was kind of down on that becoming the theme of the conference. And whales were a total freebie because the US had no whaling industry. And who did have one of the three largest whaling industries in the world at the time? The Soviets. So without being too paranoiac about it, there was a lot of interest in the US and the State Department for seeing whales dominate the media cycle around the UN conference. Better that than a consideration of questions of kind of global equity, racial equity, which were the kinds of things that were on the mind of the Eastern Bloc countries. I bet we could do more, but I know that Kyle Borman is back there, and I know he's got some stuff for you to take. I know there's some bubbly, and it's hot in here, so I bet we want to get to it. I am going to read just from the opening of the book, because it's a segue to the food. And then I'm going to introduce Kyle, and Kyle's going to say a word or two about what we've got in the back for you to taste as mock whale. Okay, so here's the opening of the book. I've eaten a bit of whale. Not a lot, but a bit. Smoked, I thought it quite like a prosciutto of boar. And as a fresh steak, very indistinguishable from elk, in my view. This was in Norway, in the company of a particular bloodthirsty... Hold on, this is my big moment. In the company of a particularly bloodthirsty spokesman for the industry, who tried, as we chewed, to sell me on the idea that every species that has any sense kills other by way of enlarging the ambit of its own vitality. He seemed, pressing this point, to deem whale conservation a kind of race suicide, which was a disorienting theory to be offered by a heavily accented German wielding a steak knife. But he was such a companionable fellow, gregarious, and enormously likable in other respects, not to mention abundantly knowledgeable about whale matters. So, thinking of Ishmael, quote, not ignoring what is good, I am quick to perceive a horror, and could still be sociable with it, would they let me, since it is but well to be on friendly terms with all the inmates of the place one lodges in, unquote, I raised a glass to human fellowship, and we drank a long draft in the beery twinkle of an endless Scandinavian summer's eve. So we have both some beer and some Prosecco, and to tell you about the whale, let me introduce the food genius, the culinary artist, Kyle Borman. Kyle, talk to us.
Hi there. So Graham sent me that introduction. So up here we have some elk, not boar, because actually wild boar in the United States, it's just domesticated pigs, regular farm pigs that they let run free. So it's not really a wild pig at all. So that's a smoked Berkshire ham from a company that's been making ham for almost 200 years now. But this one, they're doing it more in the European style. So it's smoked and then aged for 400 days before it goes off to market. The elk, there are three oils up here to season it with. It's a mixture of olive oil and jojoba oil, which chemically is almost identical to sperm whale oil. So it's been used in cosmetics as a replacement for that. It also has the effect of suppressing the human appetite. So it seemed like, oh, it kind of functions like the shift in how we viewed whales. So that's fun.
The long section in the book on how jojoba oil came to replace the oil in the aeronautics industry and so forth. So you can look it up. Jojoba oil, Catherine Hansen, who I failed to credit as being one of the crucial end game finishers as a research assistant, did that index where you'll find jojoba oil and every place it turns up. Thank you, Catherine. Kyle?
I didn't get that part of the book. So the oils are scented. One is, I was trying to, well, I had hoped to get some ambergris, which was used as an incense as well as in perfume. And it's actually something that sperm whales vomit up. And it floats around the ocean for a few years and basically cures. And when it finally hits the shore, it goes from smelling like crap to being very sweet and perfume-like. But it's incredibly expensive, about $25 a gram. And it comes from New Zealand, so that wasn't going to happen. So the first oil is scented with oysters and seaweed and not saffron. Violet candies. And there's something else in there, too. The second oil, that's like the Scandinavian spice oil. It's juniper and anise and white cardamom, and that has saffron in it. And the third one is the every other whale-eating culture oil. So that's got some, like, West Indian curry kind of flavors and yuzu and chili paste and a little sesame oil. None of that, none of the kelp's just in that one. Yeah. And then the third little thing over here is a cured, confit, and deep-fried pork belly, which, again, I was going to get wild boar, but really wild boar, just a marketing thing. So I managed to get hold of some Asaba pig belly, which it's actually the only pig in the States that's a true genetic relation to the Iberico pigs of Spain. The Spanish left them on an island in Georgia in the 1700s or 1600s, one of those two. And they've been wild there. So this actually is as close to a wild pig as you can get. A few years ago, Georgia decided to try to eradicate them because they were carrying a virus that was getting into the farm pig population. But some farmers saved a few of them, bred them for a couple years, got the virus out of them, and now they're really tasty pigs. And that's served with what was a jellied broth of lobster, crab, and shrimp. And if you have ever made a lobster broth, they tell you to remove all the insides and all that. But because the idea was that, you know, well, baleen whales eat huge amounts of shrimp whole, like millions of them in one gulp, this has like all of the innards and everything in it. So it's kind of a funky crustacean broth. And the jelly in it is actually from a pig and duck stock that I boiled down to like a really firm gelatin last week. But the steam heat of the room has caused it to melt. It needed a little sweetness, we found a couple nights ago. So it has a little bit of a anise, white cardamom, and Ricard caramel, and a dot of this other sauce that's made with a bunch of other crap. So come on up. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, so yeah, there are eyedroppers for you to try each of the three oils with three pieces of elk. Ted over here will cut off chunks of the ham, so it's less of like a slice of prosciutto and more of like a chunk of smoked whale. And that's it.